Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a stack of really crucial sources focusing on a defining reality of modern life, geriatric emergencies.
Yeah.
This isn't just about people living longer. It's really about understanding these profound, sometimes subtle, physiological shifts that totally redefine how illness and injury present after, say, age 65.
Exactly. Our mission today really is to get why, if you rely on those textbook symptoms you learned maybe years ago,
right,
you are going to miss the emergency entirely in this population. It's just different.
And the sheer scope of this challenge is, well, it's breathtaking. We are living through what people call the graying of America.
Yeah, we hear that term a lot.
Societally, we're heading toward this massive demographic squeeze where, I mean, eventually there just won't be enough working age people to support the growing need for elderly care.
Well, our sources actually put a number on that, or at least a concept. It's the old age dependency ratio.
Okay, what's that?
It's basically the ratio of older adults, you know, those potentially relying on support for every 100 younger working age adults.
And that ratio is climbing.
It's climbing fast. And that means the need for really efficient, high-stakes medical knowledge, while it's becoming urgent and expensive.
What's fascinating, though, is this paradox our sources point out in their living situation.
House.
Well, while the raw number of nursing home admissions is climbing,
right,
the vast majority of geriatric patients that EMS encounters, for example, are not living there.
Oh, interesting. So they're living independently.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah.
They maintain independent lives. We have to remember that things like financial resources, their social situation, their independence, these are often the bedrock of their health choices,
yeah,
or lack thereof.
It's that human context that really complicates the medicine, isn't it?
Absolutely. Okay, so let's unpack this medical reality. Let's start with the physical changes we need to be aware of.
Sounds good.
So the first nugget that always surprises people, I think, is that this decline in functional capacity, you know, the aging process itself, it doesn't magically start at 65.
No, not at all. It actually begins way earlier. Late 20s, early 30s, that's the starting line.
Right. And from there?
Well, the rate of decline is wildly variable. It's accelerated by genetics, of course, but also diet, activity levels, any pre-existing diseases, toxin exposure, even psychosocial factors.
So the key takeaway is?
The variability. That's the core insight here. Chronological age. It's a terrible predictor of physiological capability. You absolutely have to assess the system, the individual, not just look at their birth certificate.
Okay, let's take a system, the respiratory system. What changes there?
Well, you see a pretty significant reduction in overall respiratory capacity. Mechanically, their vital capacity, the air they can move, decreases.
Okay.
The residual volume, the air that just stays in the lungs, actually increases.
And what's the implication of that?
The implication is critical. They have an extremely limited ability to modify their respiratory rate or their tidal volume efficiently when something changes suddenly, like an acid-base imbalance.
So they can't compensate quickly.
Exactly. They can't compensate quickly. Plus, their defense mechanisms against basic infections, you know, the cough reflex, the little cilia clearing mucus, they become less effective.
Which immediately ups the infection risk.
Right. Straight away.
And that restricted ability to compensate, I imagine we see that mirrored in the cardiovascular system too.
Absolutely. There's an unavoidable decrease in efficiency there as well. Vessel walls thicken up, they lose elastin.
That flexible stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that directly contributes to systolic hypertension and general vascular stiffening.
And this is where standard triage gets tricky, right?
Completely thrown off. Think about the heart's electrical system for a second. The number of pacemaker cells actually decreases over time.
Okay, so maybe a slower resting heart rate?
It can cause that, yes. But the real danger is that after any kind of exertion or stress, even just a minor fever, a short walk, maybe a fall, it takes much, much longer for their heart rate to return to resting levels.
Ah, so standard vital signs, which rely on seeing that quick recovery or maybe a big spike in heart rate to signal stress.
They become misleading, very misleading.
And that nervous system decline we mentioned, that affects basic operations too, doesn't it?
It does. As brain weight and volume decrease, our sort of subconscious regulation of really fundamental functions starts to falter. Things like pulse rate, blood pressure, temperature control, even hunger and thirst signals.
Wow. So the body's basic thermostat and regulators are just less reliable.
Precisely. And you see the immediate consequences in their sensory world too. Vision changes often start way back in middle age, right? cataracts, glaucoma, difficulty seeing at night.
And hearing.
Then you have presbycusis. That's that gradual hearing loss that makes communication really complex. And hearing aids, well, they're expensive. They run on batteries. They can be fiddly, often a source of frustration.
You know, the detail in our sources about smell being the last sense to really diminish is fascinating.
It is, isn't it?
It means we can't rely on a patient noticing, say, spoiled food or a gas leak or maybe even smoke from a fire as quickly as a younger person might.
That's a critical safety point.
So if they can't always hear our questions clearly and maybe can't detect major environmental hazards, how can we possibly rely just on their self-report? This leads us right into the assessment challenge, doesn't it?
Exactly. We have to confront this dangerous, widespread misconception that older adults are hypochondriacs, complaining all the time.
But the reality is,
often the complete opposite. They tend not to complain, even when they have very real symptoms. Sometimes they genuinely believe their discomfort is just, you know, part of getting old.
Which forces us, as clinicians or responders, to actively hunt for the symptoms.
You have to dig.
Okay, so here's the high-stakes insight. The thing anyone in healthcare needs to know, these atypical presentations.
Yes, this is crucial.
These are the life-threatening clues that often look like nothing, or maybe something really mundane.
Absolutely. The absence of a classic textbook symptom is not reassuring. In fact, in an older adult, it should be highly alarming.
Like what? Give us an example.
Okay, a big one. Myocardial infarction. A heart attack. It might present not with that crushing chest pain we all learn about,
right?
But maybe only with profound weakness or sudden shortness of breath, or maybe just confusion. That's it.
Just confusion. Wow. And you mentioned infection risk earlier. How does that present differently?
Well, the infectious process is completely rewritten. Our sources highlight that a severe case of pneumonia might not include a fever at all.
So what does it present as instead?
Acute confusion or delirium. Delirium in this context is probably the single most important warning sign that the body's compensatory mechanisms are failing.
Delirium is the main signal for pneumonia.
Yeah. That's wild. What about metabolic issues like diabetes?
Right. If an older adult has uncontrolled diabetes, it's far more likely to present not as DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis, which we often see in younger people.
Exactly. Instead, they're more likely to present with HHNS, hyperosmolar, hyperglycemic non-ketotic syndrome.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Why is HHNS so concerning compared to DKA?
Okay, so DKA involves ketones and a protective acidosis, which at least forces the body to try and compensate, like through breathing changes.
Right, cusmal respirations.
Yeah. HHNS, on the other hand, is characterized by profound, extreme dehydration and dangerously high glucose levels, but without those protective ketones, without the acidosis.
So just quieter.
Much quieter. This silent, non-acidotic onset means they often present much later in the illness, already severely dehydrated and critically ill. It makes recovery incredibly difficult.
And that underlying complexity is amplified by comorbidity, right? Mm-hmm. Having multiple health problems at once.
Oh, absolutely. Multiple pathologic conditions coexisting where the symptoms of one disease might totally hide another. It's like a serious domino effect.
And then you layer on polypharmacy, taking tons of medications.
Yeah, that's a huge one. It's almost a linear relationship. The more pills they take, the higher the likelihood they're going to end up hospitalized.
Why is that? Is it just interactions?
Interactions are a big part, yes.
Yeah.
But also, remember their hepatic enzyme systems, the liver systems, the detoxified drugs, they decline with age.
Ah, so they can't process the drugs as efficiently.
Exactly. So multiple medications interacting plus slower processing significantly increases the risk for liver damage and general drug toxicity. Standard drug dosages, often wildly inaccurate for them.
Okay, so given all this complexity, the atypical symptoms, the comorbidities, the polypharmacy, what assessment framework should someone use? How do you approach this?
The sources strongly advocate for using the GEMS diamond.
GEMS?
Yeah, GMS. G for geriatric patient, always keep their specific needs in mind. E for environmental assessment, check their surroundings for clues. M for medical assessment, the usual vital signs and history, but with caveats. And SS for social assessment.
The social part seems key here.
It's absolutely key. We must look beyond the immediate illness. Ask about their living situation, their support network, who helps them. And, crucially, get a detailed medication history.
And not just what's prescribed.
No, everything. Prescribed meds, meds they're supposed to take but maybe aren't. Over-the-counters, supplements, maybe meds from other doctors they forgot to mention. That level of detail is non-negotiable. It takes time, but it's critical.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly to neurological differences. We need to clearly define the difference between two terms that get confused a lot, but signal totally different paths: delirium and dementia.
Yes, this distinction is vital for getting the care right. Delirium. Think of delirium as a temporary symptom. It reflects some kind of serious underlying disturbance.
Like what?
Like an infection, as we said, or maybe underhydration, low oxygen levels, something acute. Its onset is abrupt, happens over hours to days.
And if you fix the underlying problem?
The delirium typically resolves. It's reversible.
Okay, contrast that with dementia.
Dementia is different. Dementia produces irreversible brain failure. It's characterized by a progressive loss of function, memory impairment, difficulty performing daily activities. It gets worse over time.
Not temporary, not reversible.
Correct. And when you're dealing with that sudden onset of delirium, there's actually a helpful mnemonic our sources mention to remember the potential underlying causes. D-E-L-I-R-I-U-M-S.
Okay, let's break that down quickly.
Sure. D is for drugs or toxins. E for emotional factors like severe stress. L is for low PaO2, low oxygen. I is for infection, a really common cause.
Right.
R is for retention of stool or urine. Sounds simple, but it can cause it. I is for ictal events, meaning seizures. U is for undernutrition or underhydration. M is for metabolism issues like thyroid problems or, again, blood sugar extremes. And SS is for subdural hematoma, a bleed in the brain.
Which we should talk more about later, definitely.
We should. But the point is, this temporary confusion delirium, it can be the first and sometimes the only sign of something life-threatening like sepsis or severe hypoglycemia. You can't ignore it.
Got it. And when we talk about the chronic, irreversible side, dementia, Alzheimer's disease, or AD is the most common form, right?
It is. It causes that progressive functional loss, losing things, difficulty recalling names or words, eventually inability to perform basic self-care.
And it's important to stress, AD is not believed to be just part of normal aging.
That's a critical distinction. It's a distinct disease process.
We also need to briefly mention Parkinson's disease.
Yes, another age-related neurologic disorder, defined by those core symptoms, often arresting tremor, usually in a hand or foot, slowness of movement, what we call bradykinesia, muscle rigidity, and poor balance.
And that leads to a whole spectrum of functional loss.
It does, including things like depression and, in some cases, dementia can develop later on as well.
Okay, we've covered major system failures like cardio, respiratory, neuro. But let's touch on the plumbing and processing systems. GI and renal failure there also complicates everything.
Absolutely. GI changes start literally in the mouth. Fewer taste buds, reduced saliva production, potential dental loss or problems.
And ill-fitting dentures. That's not just uncomfortable.
No, it's a risk. Ill-fitting dentures themselves can pose a risk for choking, also heartburn, and even abdominal pain if they can't chew properly. Further down the tract, peristalsis, the gut movement, slows down.
Meaning?
Meaning constipation is really common, and it's often worsened by medications they're taking, or maybe inactivity or poor diet.
But the danger, the real escalation, happens when we look at the renal system, the kidneys. Our sources talk about a loss of functioning nephron units.
Yes, the kidney function generally declines. And here is where dehydration can become a sudden catastrophe.
Why so suddenly?
This is perhaps one of the most critical homeostatic failures to understand. Aging kidneys respond very slowly to sodium deficiency. They don't conserve salt well when needed.
Okay.
Now, combine that slow kidney response with the nervous system decline we talked about earlier, specifically that decreased thirst mechanism.
They don't feel thirsty even when they need water.
Exactly. You put those two together, slow kidneys and no thirst signal, and you get the rapid, sudden development of severe dehydration. The body loses its primary defenses against volume loss. It happens fast.
And conversely, are they also at risk of overhydration?
Equally at risk, yes. If they're given large sodium loads, like maybe too much IV saline or just fluids too quickly in a clinical setting, they lack the mechanism to handle those sudden volume changes effectively.
So it creates this razor-thin margin for error when you're managing their fluid status.
Extremely thin. Very easy to tip them one way or the other.
Okay, so all these vulnerabilities we've discussed, the slower reflexes, visual deficits, hearing issues, those equilibrium disorders, reduced agility.
Yeah.
They all sort of stack up, don't they?
They do.
Which leads directly into our final point. These high-risk situations like trauma and abuse.
Right. When trauma happens to fall, a car accident, the outcomes are often dramatically less favorable. Because those compromised compensatory mechanisms we've been talking about mean they simply cannot withstand the shock as well. A blood pressure reading that might signal only minor hypotension in a younger person could actually indicate life-threatening shock in an older trauma patient.
Their normal isn't the same.
Not at all. And they're inherently more likely to sustain a serious injury from less force. Think about it. Stiffened blood vessels, more fragile tissues, demineralized bones.
Osteoporosis.
Exactly. Everything is just more brittle.
And there's a specific terrifying point in the sources regarding head trauma.
Yes, this is critical. Because the cerebral blood vessels are more fragile, and also because the brain tends to shrink slightly with age, creating a larger subdural space.
Okay.
A hematoma, a bleed in that space, often develops incredibly slowly, over days or even weeks.
Days or weeks, so you could send someone home after a seemingly minor fall.
Completely missing a silent, slow-moving bleed, a potential killer. The initial symptoms might just be subtle drowsiness or maybe slightly depressed consciousness, easily missed or attributed to something else.
That's sobering. Which brings us, unfortunately, to the tragedy of elder abuse.
Yeah. Abuse is defined very broadly in this context. It covers physical abuse, obviously, but also emotional abuse, financial exploitation, passive neglect, like not providing needed care, and willful deprivation.
And the sources point out something chilling about the abuser.
They do. The abuser is almost always known to the person being abused. Very often, it's a family member, a spouse, a child, another relative.
So what clues should people look for?
Things like unexplained injuries, maybe bruises or burns that don't quite fit the story given, or injuries in unusual places. Also signs of poor hygiene, malnutrition, dehydration, sometimes withdrawal or fearfulness.
And if abuse is suspected?
The absolute importance of documenting observations objectively.
Facts, not judgments.
Exactly, just the facts. And reporting those suspicions to the relevant authorities, adult protective services, law enforcement, depending on the situation, it's paramount.
Because the victims often can't report it themselves.
Precisely. They might be too fearful or physically unable or maybe cognitively impaired. Vigilance from others is key.
Okay, so to sum up our deep dive today. It really confirms that treating geriatric patients requires this fundamental shift in our expectation of normal.
Absolutely.
We have to recognize these profound, often quiet, physiological changes, starting surprisingly quite early in life, and the way they lead to these atypical presentations of disease. Confusion instead of fever, maybe profound weakness instead of crushing chest pain.
It's about recalibrating your index of suspicion.
And if we connect this back to the bigger picture, you mentioned the psychosocial factors earlier. It seems impossible to really separate the purely medical from the psychosocial, doesn't it?
Completely impossible. Our sources mention Erik Erikson's stages, specifically the crisis of integrity versus despair. You know, where a person looks back and measures their pride and their accomplishments against a feeling of maybe unaccomplished goals or regrets.
Integrity versus despair.
Right. And we see these powerful psychosocial factors, mourning the loss of physical ability, maybe feeling useless after retirement, bereavement, financial stress. They profoundly influence the aging process and overall health.
So building on that, here's a provocative thought for you, our listener, to consider. We know that financial strain affects whether someone takes their medication properly. We know bereavement or feeling isolated can exacerbate systemic stress.
Mm-hmm.
How do these deep psychosocial factors, things like that crisis of despair, how do they act as these silent compounding risk factors in an emergency context? How might they complicate both the diagnosis and the recovery process?
And maybe take it a step further. What societal supports or even individual supports could potentially mitigate that sense of despair? Could addressing those factors actually make older adults more resilient, ultimately improving their health outcomes before they even reach an emergency situation?
Something to think about long after this deep dive ends. Until next time, stay curious.